More than 1,500 people were in the streets, many hurling rocks and bottles at the police or anyone else, some attacking the cars of people, white or Negro, who just passed by. 15 citizens injured, 19 officers hurt, none seriously, 31 arrested, 12 juveniles.
The voice of KNXT newsman Bill Stout describing the scene 55 years ago next Tuesday, when a large portion of Los Angeles suffered not just damage to structures and fires, but there was widespread injury to people, police abuse that took place on those who were taken to the streets in what became known as the Watts Riot or Watt Uprising. 34 people were killed. There were more than 1,000 injuries. And this morning on Air Talk, we're going to look back at that event 55 years ago, the multiple days of the Watts riots, and talk about what came out of that experience, dramatic changes that unfolded in Los Angeles, and the effect of the actions of police, of protesters and rioters over the course of the event. I was 6 years old at the time, living in what's now called Baldwin Village. It was called the Jungle at the time, a portion of Los Angeles that was in transition from what had been a dominantly white neighborhood to African American. And as a boy, I was living there as that process was unfolding, and we evacuated the apartment where we lived right off of La Brea, across from the Baldwin Theater, because of concerns that rioting could come to the street where we lived. The images on television were indelible for me as a kid, seeing fires set the thrifty drugstore just down the street where my dad worked on La Brea, burned to the ground. Burned again the riots after the Rodney King verdict, a second time that same thrifty was burned down. But we're going to take a look back at that history with a historian, Brenda Stevenson, professor of African American Studies at UCLA. Professor Stevenson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about the incident that began all this. Obviously, we're going to get into the historic elements that caused the city to erupt. But what was the spark for the beginning of the riots?
Well, I don't think anyone will be surprised that the spark had to do something with a black male and a policeman. And so it was Marquette Frye, who was driving his mother, Rena Price's car, 1955 Buick. He was pulled over by chiefs. He was on parole. He had been drinking. There was an attempt to arrest him. A crowd grew around the policemen and Marquette and his brother. His brother ran home to tell his mother what was going on. His mother appeared. The crowd got bigger. There was an argument. People were shoved, including the mother, including Marquette, including some police personnel, and including a woman that people thought was pregnant. And so the crowd was very upset about this. And from that really was the spark that led to the insurrection in August of 1965.
And was there a sense in the city at the time, because I was too little to be aware of this, that with the civil rights movement, with the louder voice of African Americans in Los Angeles for representation and fighting against restrictive covenants and police abuses, was there a sense that the city was ripe for an explosion like this?
Well, there were many things that would lead people to believe that this could happen. I mean, of course, the housing issue was very key at the time. The fact that, you know, there was so little housing, Blacks people, or we were crowded into, very small places and also into very limited communities. Secondarily, there was continually police presence and surveillance and negative or violent interactions between the police and the community that had happened over, you know, generations. And so people were very tense about that too. There were many other things going on as well, but there also was, I think, a kind of a sense of that Los Angeles was being bypassed to a certain extent with regard to the civil rights movement. In 1964, the Civil Rights Act, 1965, the Voting Rights Act. But what was going to change in Los Angeles? What was changing in Los Angeles? I mean, there was some slow movement movement towards housing reform, but there's also high unemployment. There was the, you know, healthcare issues, there were educational issues, there was poverty, of course, issues of poverty as well. And then there was a policing issue. So there was a lot of emphasis that had occurred, you know, with regard to the American South and with regard to desegregation, the ending of, you know, Jim Crow legislation, integration of schools, et cetera. Much of that was really focused on the American South and not the American West. And so, you know, there were growing frustrations about what was going to happen, how were lives going to be radically and better and changed for the better in a place like Los Angeles.
We're talking with UCLA historian and professor Brenda E. Stevenson. Professor Stevenson, you mentioned the South. How did the Western migration of African Americans from states like Texas and Louisiana, how did that also factor into this? Because you had a growing African-American population, many of whom came for jobs in the factories that were higher paying than the states where they had come from. And was there in some sense also, as there was more economic power in the Black community, did that also lead to the demand for more representation?
Absolutely. I mean, African-Americans left the South. You know, whether we're looking at the first migration, which kind of missed Los Angeles, but the second migration, certainly after during World War II to work in the defense industry and allied industries, brought, you know, tens of thousands of African-Americans into the city. I mean, it really, the presence of African-Americans grew tremendously during this time period. And as, you know, the city, those people who were already in the city clearly were not ready for that enormous growth necessary during the time of the World War II and the defense industry. But afterwards, you know, again, this notion of, you know, where are African Americans going to fit into our society? African Americans left for a better life. African Americans left the South to have equity in the law, to find job opportunities, to have better education, to have better housing, et cetera. So African Americans left the South looking for the American dream in the West. The other thing too, though, is that African Americans are not the only people leaving Louisiana and Texas. There is a huge white migration at the same time. So that at the same time that you are seeing large numbers of African Americans arriving in Southern California, you're also seeing large numbers of white Southerners arriving in Los Angeles and in Southern California. And they're bringing with them the same ideas of racial etiquette that they had in the American South.
And working at, I'm sorry to interrupt, I was just going to say, working at many of the same workplaces.
Exactly. Working that same with many workplaces and also, you know, competing for the same kinds of resources. They also want a better life than what the American South was offering them at the time. But they were not necessarily ready to embrace a different kind of racial etiquette than what they were used to in the American South.
UCLA history professor and professor of African American studies, Brenda E. Stevenson, with us. We're looking back at the Watts riots 55 years ago, next Tuesday, a week from today. Also with us, like me, he was just a kid growing up in Los Angeles at the time of the riots, Los Angeles County Supervisor Mark Ridley Thomas. His district includes Culver City, Southwest Los Angeles, west side of LA. Supervisor, thank you very much for being with us. How old were you at the time of the riots?
Well, 1965, I was just making 11 years old. I was born in 1954.
All right. So where were you going to school at the time?
I was a student at the time at Ascot Elementary School, not far from where a lot of the destruction and reaction was taking place at Vernon and Central, just east of there.
And what are your memories of that time? Your fears, the range of your emotions as a kid at that time.
An indelible impression of the National Guard at the corners of Hooper Avenue and Vernon Avenue, and I saw them with my own eyes. I stood there, and it's almost as if I can still smell the smoke from the fires and the destruction that took place at the time. And I don't think that image will ever leave my mind. The young men who were on the back of that truck as National Guards men, and they were carrying what appeared to be very large weapons, specifically rifles. That's the most pronounced recollection that I have.
You know the late Joe Hicks, who told a story about he was a young man at the time and sitting on the porch of his house having a beer, and I believe it was a National Guardsman, came up to him, pointed a rifle at him, used a racial slur to him, and told him to get off the porch of his own home. And there's so many searing memories of what people experience. Supervisor Mark Ridley Thomas, were there any of the people in your family who faced those kinds of incidents during the days of the riots?
I have no specific recollection of those individuals. I can tell you that it was just a very tumultuous, a very upsetting, a very divisive moment in time, but born out of disparity, born out of inequity, born out of policies that had to be seen as racist practices that had been heaped upon communities in Los Angeles, particularly African-Americans, but not exclusively African-Americans, in terms of the longstanding conflict with law enforcement, specifically Los Angeles Police Department, and beyond, not exclusively the LAPD. And so all of that was building up, and it certainly defined the relationships of the community in which I lived. And I'd have to hasten to make the point that I was hardly unaffected by that in terms of my own development and consciousness and the pursuit for justice and fairness and equity.
And I want to continue with you by talking about the ways that Los Angeles city and county government has evolved in the 55 years since. We're talking about the Watts riots of 1965 in Los Angeles. We're talking with L.A. County Supervisor Mark Ridley Thomas. I'd like to hear from you if you have memories, you're old enough to have memories of the Watts riots to share with us, and any questions that you have of our expert guests who can talk about the personal experience of it as well as the important effects of the riots many years later. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Also with us, Los Angeles-based civil rights attorney and a member, a life member of our Southern California Public Radio Board of Trustees, Connie Rice. Connie, so good to have you with us again.
Good to be with you, Larry.
Connie, what do you see as the most important events that came out of the aftermath of the riots?
I think the most important event is the report that came following the 1965 uprising. It was the McCone Commission, and it was supposed to analyze what caused it as if it were a mystery. You've got the kindling that the professor has described and the supervisor has described. All of that builds up, and you add the match of police abuse and misconduct, and the tensions just explode. It's the formula that you've seen all around the country and that you saw in that time in almost every major American city. So the post-riot audits, like Kerner Commission would come in 67. Well, McCone came after the 1965 Los Angeles riots. And that was the report that said, look, if you want to avoid future uprisings and riots and destruction like this, you've got to reduce the friction between African-American communities and the police, so fix your cops and make them community officers. And the second thing you have to do is what I believe Yvonne Braithwaite-Burke, who is counsel to the commission, she came up with this phrase of end the spiral of despair. And so you have to do both. It's not enough to just fix the police. You have to end the deprivation, the defunding of these communities. No housing, no grocery stores, no banks, no credit unions, just the basics that make a community viable and functioning. And what I would say is that in the 55 years, we've done this tango several times, and we haven't learned that lesson. We have not. We've been trying to fix the police. It's not your grandfather's LAPD, but it's not Martin Luther King's LAPD either. We've got a long way to go, but we have been working on the police. What I haven't seen is the investment side in these communities. Now, look at 1992, the next big police commission or post-uprising analysis was the 1992 Rodney King uprising, reaction to the verdicts and the beating of Rodney King when the officers were acquitted. And we once again did an analysis. The Christopher Commission did a great big cultural analysis of LAPD right after that. Same recommendations. Go to community policing, fix the culture, change the incentives. Go to guardians instead of gladiators. The same set of recommendations that LAPD refused to do. And on top of that, again, invest in these communities. Well, we did rebuild LA. I don't know if you remember that, Larry. We sourced it to a corporate entity. It's quasi-corporate, quasi-governmental. There's a lot of corporate folks on there, and they did a great service in saying that the cost for giving the neighborhoods of South L.A. the basic upward mobility infrastructure, job creation, banks, grocery stores, a few health clinics, refurbished King Drew, and so forth, that agenda was given a price tag of $6 billion with a B. Rebuild L.A. raised at maximum $500 million, $500 million. And most of the investments went into mini malls and development it didn't produce a lot of jobs, but it was fleeting. And today, if you look at Latinx and African-American unemployment in South L.A., it's still hovering around 28-29%. So no deep structural change, no real investment to end the spiral of despair that the McCone Commission talked about in 1965. And so I guess I would say, some lessons learned, but many more not learned.
I didn't realize that Yvonne Burke, or Brathwaite, I should say, was the counsel to the McCone Commission. She, of course, went on to be elected to the state legislator and Los Angeles County Supervisor as well, in a long career in Los Angeles elective office. It's interesting that that was that really, Connie, where she came to public prominence?
I don't think so. I think when she ran for Congress and other things from there, she was a young lawyer on the staff, just like there were 80 lawyers on the Christopher Commission.
Wow.
Staff. There were a number of lawyers. The lawyers are the ones who do the investigation and write these reports, and you know, the commissioners adopt the findings. But bottom line, Larry, is that we've made progress in a lot of ways. But it's not progress that the street can feel. And I wrote an editorial saying, until you end the warrior culture of policing and the suppression, containment, mass incarceration mission, you're going to continue to get the kind of friction, the kind of devastation. I mean, 55 years later, if you're an African-American man living in Nickerson Gardens housing project, a Harvard economist studied Nickerson Gardens, which is such a huge housing project that it has its own census tract. But if you're an African-American man between 18 and 24 and you step out of your unit in Nickerson Gardens, every time you step out of your unit, you face a 45% chance of going to jail. That's what mass incarceration looks like. And it's, you know, the police didn't come up with this. They are the enactors of it. They are the enforcers of it. They are the instrument by which the policy is carried out. But California decided to build prisons like pell-mell. I mean, we built prisons so rapidly and so quickly. We built more prisons in a five-year period than we had in the previous 50 years. And we filled them. And we filled them with poor men of color, poor women of color. And that's on us. So when Martin Luther King Jr. addressed riots, he basically said, until you get full equality, full integration, not just desegregation, until you get full economic participation and electoral participation, until power is really shared, and until the country is willing to do what he called, these are not my words, quote, radical reconstruction of the deep inequities in American society. We haven't been able to, we haven't been willing to do superficial reconstruction, never mind radical reconstruction.
Well,
so I think that's what we're faced with now in this inflection on what causes riots. We're now having a fourth national debate about how much racism and how much structural racism is America comfortable with. That's always been the debate.
Connie Rice, LA-based civil rights attorney, joining us. Mark Ridley Thomas, Los Angeles County supervisor, historian from UCLA, Professor Brenda Stevenson. We look back 55 years ago next Tuesday, the Watts riots in Los Angeles. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. We'll be back in 1 minute.
It was the most widespread, most destructive racial violence in American history. White people driving through the riot area were considered fair game, whether young or old, men or women. Their cars were battered, the drivers stoned, kicked and beaten, and the cars were burned.
That's how Los Angeles television covered the Watts riots of 1965, 55 years ago. We're talking about the ongoing effects of that first riot or uprising, however you prefer to term it, here in Los Angeles. And, of course, 1992, after the Rodney King officers were acquitted. And we had then, of course, the protests that happened here in Southern California just a few weeks ago. If you want to share your memories of Watts 1965, we're at 866-893-KPECC. You can also post on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Mark Ridley Thomas, Los Angeles County Supervisor, who was growing up in Los Angeles, 11 years old at the time of Watts 1965. Supervisor Ridley Thomas, you said this played no small part in your career decision going into political life. So what have been the changes, particularly in African-American representation in the 55 years since?
Well, I think it's important to recognize, and it's interesting that we talk about the uprising in Watts in 65, that which captured the imagination of the nation at the time was that which was going on in Selma as well, sequential activity in the period of the 60s, and then ultimately the Voting Rights Act. And so pursuant to the Voting Rights Act, you had a significant uptick in the number of African Americans who were elected to public office. And I do mean significant. It more than doubled, Larry. And we have an able historian who can document the increase in African-American representation across the nation. It didn't escape Los Angeles. Actually, it was in 1963 when the first African-American was elected to the city council in Los Angeles. It followed with two additional persons there, Tom Bradley, Gil Lindsay, Billy Mills, and it moved from there. So there's been a cadre of representatives in public office, largely attributable to the work of he who has now passed on, namely John Lewis. It's an interesting historical narrative that informs this discussion. And so in many respects, it has to be appreciated that I'm in part a beneficiary of that movement. And obviously, my career at the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, where Connie Rice and I collaborated on a number of projects when she was at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. And I just simply know that the move for justice continues to evolve, the move for fairness, the move for the expansion of fundamental rights. And yet the excessive use of force that still marks the lives of all too many people, particularly unarmed African Americans, disproportionately African American males, is a stain on the image of law enforcement in this nation. It is not irrelevant that when you look at LA County, African Americans represent 8% of the population, but when you look at the period of 2017, 27% of those who were either shot or seriously injured by law enforcement in LA County, it's 27% of that 688 individuals. And I have to say to you that this level of disproportionality is precisely what gives rise to Justice LA, gives rise to Black Lives Matter, gives rise to a range of issues. And so we're pushing forward.
You mentioned Gil Lindsay, who is an incredible story. I mean, born in Mississippi at the turn of the century, was a janitor at Los Angeles City Hall and became the first Black city council member, a very powerful official in Los Angeles, lived to 90 years of age. Gil Lindsay really starting with that prominent African-American political representation in Los Angeles. Let's take listener calls. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Brenda in South Los Angeles, what's your memory of Watts 65?
Hi, I, like Supervisor Margaret Lee Thomas, was 12 years old. He was a little bit younger than me, but I lived in Imperial Court, and I remember very distinctly the National Guard coming and walking down the street with rifles, and my grandmother, I lived with her, and making us sleep on the floor because she was afraid of bullets. But the other thing that went away was we used to have the donut man that would come every day, and she would buy donuts from him, and he would give us cream puffs. And we used to get milk delivered in a bottle with cream on top. And she would trade eggs and vegetables with our neighbors, and all of that stopped and was replaced by government cheese and powdered milk and handouts from the government, because we couldn't go to the stores and we couldn't move and we couldn't have the types of freedom to have community like we did before the riots. So it destroyed that sense of neighborhood and the ability to communicate with one another and to have good food.
Yeah, Brenda, thank you for sharing your experience growing up in Imperial Court's housing project. Brenda in South Los Angeles, we're at 866-893-KPECC. Rona in Beverly Hills, I understand your father owned a couple of theaters on Central Avenue, which was the heart of the African-American community in L.A.
Yes, my father owned the Lincoln and the Bill Robinson. In 65, I was 15, but before that, my earlier childhood, I believe he owned them since probably, definitely through the 50s, maybe even earlier. And of course, the riots, that was the end of the theater business for him. What happened was, I believe they burned a lot of the blocks there, but they did not burn the two theaters. But of course, he couldn't go back and...
Oh, boy, we just lost that call suddenly. That's unfortunate. Yeah, the Lincoln Theater, very important historical site on Central Avenue, as is the Dunbar Hotel. The Lincoln is now a church, but the building is still there. And the Dunbar, which was the place because of all the restrictions that, you know, African Americans could not stay in hotels in Los Angeles, they were off limits to African Americans. So the Dunbar housed some of the most important, prominent African Americans in the country when they visited Los Angeles, including the jazz greats who played at clubs on Central Avenue, but also other very prominent intellectuals and artists, African Americans. Brenda Stevenson, UCLA historian, can you briefly speak of the importance of Central Avenue in Los Angeles?
Well, Central Avenue was a cultural center and also a residential center for African Americans. It was the place where African Americans had found to express themselves culturally as well as entrepreneurially. It was known nationally as a place where African Americans did well, where music, jazz in particular, was not founded there, but certainly did thrive there. It was also a location, as you indicated, where the illustrious came when they came to Los Angeles, whether or not they were film stars, whether or not they were, you know, musicians, politicians, leaders, political leaders, etc. They stayed on Dunbar Avenue. It was a place where there was a deep, deep cultural community. And where, you know, people of all classes intermingle with one another. I mean, in some ways, that's what segregation did, of course, was to pull everyone together. And so even the most distinguished person, the most well-educated, wealthiest, whatever, knew the, you know, person who was less so, because everyone came to Central Avenue, whether or not, you know, to go to a club or to work there or to deliver goods there or to go to church there or to have their hair cut there or, you know, et cetera. It was the hub of Black life in Los Angeles.
And Professor, is it, I mean, this is one of so many racial ironies in America, that when there were no other opportunities for places to live because of these restrictive racial covenants, it compelled African-American Angelenos to live largely in that community, which was multi-strata, as you described, professionals with working class families, people of all different means and status. And once those restrictions broke down and African-Americans could live in different parts of Los Angeles, that community was lost. And obviously, no one wants segregation to keep a community intact, but it is ironic.
Well, yes, but there are other kinds of things around the community that also, you know, lent to the community being lost as well. There were, you know, in terms of the way things were redistricted, et cetera, people moved onward to other places and all of that. Leimert Park, for example, is a great example today of, you know, another cultural hub where people of all classes and ways of life, et cetera, come together. But because of gentrification, for example, that's threatened. So, yeah, you know, different things do happen to disperse the community in a sense. Of course, there are political and other kinds of issues that continue to unite the community, but just as a particular space. And having this kind of segregated community is something that was national, you know, not just in Los Angeles, but it was actually a form of Jim Crow that people believed would indicate that, you know, separate and equal could be separate and equal, was to make certain that Black people, even if we were, could not move to a certain community, well, they have a swimming pool there and they have a ballroom there and they have a club there and they have a, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it actually was a strategy for, quote unquote, making sure Jim Crow was legal according to the terms of the, you know, of the 1896 Supreme Court case.
I want to thank you all for being with us and providing your expertise and your thoughts about the impact 55 years later of Watts 65. That's Brenda E. Stevenson, professor at UCLA, professor of history and African American studies. Also with us, Connie Rice, Los Angeles-based civil rights attorney and lifetime trustee of Southern California Public Radio, and Los Angeles County Supervisor Mark Ridley Thomas, who was, like me, just a kid at the time of the Watts riots, but the images are indelible. Coming up, we talk with LA Metro CEO Phil Washington about public transit and the challenges in ridership it's facing right now. We'll be back in 90 seconds on Air Talk.